Welcome to the GBC Big Three podcast, a weekly podcast where we sit down and unpack three big questions raised from our Sunday sermon. I'm your host, Matt Willis, and joining me for another week of the Big Three is none other than the delightful Jessica Baker. Welcome, Jessica Baker.
Thanks, Matt Willis.
How you going,
good to
my
be
friend?
Here. Yeah, good, good. Loving life.
Loving life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We had our first on-site service on Sunday.
We did.
How'd you go?
Oh, delightful. It's the same. You know, it's good to be back. It's nice. It's comforting. Yep. It's good to see everyone's faces.
It's the warm and fuzzies.
Yeah. Went out for dinner after, sat on the lawn, all legal, delightful. It's a good time. And worship was on point. Very good.
Bless them.
Yeah.
Oh, it was lovely to be back in the room. And to, and then we had like chats after, like we had discussions around
chats,
the sermon.
The chats were good too.
Yeah.
It was nice.
Love that. It was good. It was good. Mm-hmm. And you registered, which was super
helpful. I did register, yes. I got the passive-aggressive text today and we'll register later.
It was not passive-aggressive.
No, it was delightful, but I was like, I can see Matt Willis shaking his head at me because I haven't registered yet. But I will. I'll be there this Sunday.
In your defense, the link to register was not available until... today.
Oh, okay. Very good.
So,
all right, fine. I'm not
you're
that
good.
Behind.
You're good. It's fine. I will just flag that as we record the Big Three today, there are people walking on the roof, ripping sheets of metal off the roof, just hurling it out into the street. It's all very safe, but it is also very noisy. So when you hear the big bangs of them just like ripping metal from metal, it's all good. We're fine. We're safe. Don't be concerned, anyone listening. We're good.
Very good.
Yes, okay.
And apologies for the noise, I think is what you were trying to say.
Yeah, that too. Apologies for the noise.
I don't think they care much about whether we're safe or not.
Oh my gosh, are they going to be okay? Well, for those of you who missed it, Belinda Lakeland preached during our online and on-site services this past Sunday. And she continued in our series, Lives Changed by Jesus, looking at 10 stories from the New Testament of people's encounters with Jesus. And you can listen to that message again through our regular GBC sermon podcast. But unfortunately, Belinda couldn't be here for the Big Three, so instead we'll be joined by Mark Rader. Jess and I will be putting the Big Three questions to him as we dive deeper into the invitation from this week's sermon. But for now, Jess... keen to hear. What were your thoughts on Belinda's message on Sunday?
Oh, woos. What a woman. So good. It was so good.
She really like stirs the heart, doesn't she?
She brings all the feels. You can tell she's just so passionate.
Mm.
And when she's talking about the woman crying over how Jesus has been shamed, I'm like, are you going to cry? Like, you just look like you love Jesus so much.
She does.
She does,
really
clearly.
Does.
Yes, which is, you know, a good thing for
it
a
is
pastor.
A good thing. Yeah, yeah.
But no, I loved her sermon. It, that story has always been like a bit random. I get you love Jesus. Why are you wasting all your perfume kind of vibes? But she really kind of put it in a light where I was like, oh, I really understand the setting kind of perfectly, hopefully, of what it actually was like.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, oh, okay, I understand why she does that now. And I really like that's really beautiful kind of way to kind of stand up for Jesus what I'm trying
absolutely.
To say. Yeah.
I could see you struggling. And
I was struggling.
Yeah.
My brain stopped working halfway through the sentence. You didn't jump in and help, but that's fine.
No, I just watched it crash and burn. No, I agree. And I loved the way Belinda kind of retold the story and gave such new insight into, like, I think my reflection of that story is you've heard it so many times and you make so many assumptions about who the woman is and the past that she's had and even Simon, the Pharisee, like, but the way Belinda kind of, I guess, shed new light on it, I was like, that Simon was this like political kind of jerk,
I
say
it? Slithery little snake.
He was. Did you call him a Slytherin?
A slithering. A slithery little snake.
He would be in Slytherin.
He would be in Slytherin. Correct.
Absolutely. But like that, he was totally setting Jesus up for.
How naughty.
I know.
So rude.
I've been watching this political thriller, so I'm more like. I'm just like, oh, like I totally like can empathize with what Jesus was going through in that moment. What a dirty deed it was from Simon.
Mm.
But yeah, great.
So rude.
Great. It was rude.
Also, what a resourceful woman. She's like, what have I got? I got my tears from my face. I've got my hair and I've got this random fragrance box that I brought. I'm going to wash his feet. I just feel like, that's clever. What a gal.
Scent a la woman.
I don't know whether that would be a nice scent.
Yeah,
but
who knows? Yeah. Well, maybe not 2,000 years ago.
No, potentially not.
But that's okay. Well, I think it's time for us to start looking at the three big questions submitted through Slater this week. So, Jess, what are our big three?
So, question one is, in what ways do Christians assume the role of Simon, and what impact does that have on people's experience of Jesus? It's that's too heavy. Real. Yeah, it's heavy. We've just called him a slithery little snake.
But it's true. I had Dan Pasqualino on my table when we were discussing after the sermon, and he kind of made that point. He was like, I think we like to think of ourselves as the woman, but more often than not, we're Simon. I was like, oh, real talk?
It's rough. Let's get into it. I'm excited. Question two, Jesus welcomes this woman who society and religion said was unworthy. How do we go about welcoming those on the fringe?
Boom.
Love that.
Came for it.
And question three, how do we honor Jesus when our society regularly shames him? This is something that on my table, I was like, look, I would stand up for Jesus a whole lot more if he was actually at the party with me and could back it up. Like, the woman puts herself out there and Jesus is like, hey, everyone, shut up. She's amazing. Like, I'd do that every time.
What did Jesus say to Thomas? You believe because you see. Blessed are those who believe.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. See? All right, fine. Giving me shade. Fine, I'll set up for Jesus more, okay? But all right, moving on.
No shame. Listen, I think there's only one thing missing. I'm not sure if I'm the one to be answering these questions. So let's welcome in Mark Rader. Great to have you on the Big Three.
Thanks, Matt. Hey, Jess.
Just to let you know, Mark, Matt's in a savage mood today, so just be really careful.
Dear. It's not only the roof having things ripped off, huh?
Yeah.
Do you know what's terrible? It's that I don't think I'm aware of it. So I'm here being like, what? I'm not being savage at all.
A sheer delight. Here I am crying in the corner with my microphone.
Now who's in Slytherin House?
Simon.
Rader, how did you feel having people back in the building again on Sunday?
Yeah, like it's nice. It's that sense of familiarity. I mean, it is still weird, you know, given the current state of our health restrictions that, you know, everyone's masked up and we can't sing in corporate worship. And so it's still not quite normal in that sense, but it's just good to have people in the room and, you know, see some faces that, you know, you may not have seen online or even if you have, you haven't had the opportunity to interact with them at all.
Yeah.
So in lots of ways, it's just, it's nice. You know, I think one of the things that we're grappling with a little bit here is, how do we continue to affirm and serve our online community? So we don't want to kind of go, oh, on-site's the only way.
Yeah.
But it was really nice to have people in the building again, you know.
Yeah.
So it was great. It's a good first step. It didn't feel as complicated from a kind of an administrative end in terms of how we did that in a COVID safe way
as we've done last time. Before, so.
Yeah. So, like, you know, all that sort of stuff. It was just, a nice first step. Looking forward to that slow re-engagement process as people get used to it again.
Yeah,
so, awesome. Yeah, but it was really good.
It was good. It was great. Well, just a little free plug. If anyone wants to register for our on-site services this coming Friday morning at 10 a.m. and Sunday evening at 6 p.m., you can head to our website, guymebaptist.org.au, follow the links to register. But for now, let's get into the big three. So, Mark, as I said, someone made a point on Sunday that too often we kind of position ourselves with the woman in this story and kind of see Simon as the villain and kind of distance ourselves from him. But in a number of ways, Christians can kind of take on the role of Simon, this Pharisee who had a lot of justification around what he was saying and why he was saying it, and society and societal norms would have backed him up completely. So in what ways do Christians now assume the role of Simon, and what impact does that have on people exploring and experiencing Jesus?
There's probably several ways that we end up taking on the persona of Simon. And I think a lot of them, I think it's helpful to recall that Jesus and the Pharisees actually had an enormous amount in common. Like in terms of all the political parties, you know, like the, you know, the Essenes, who were kind of the Dead Sea Scroll folks, who kind of basically said the world's going to hell in a handbasket, so we're going to go and establish our own little society. Jesus didn't have a lot in common with them. The Sadducees, who were linked with the temple and with the political families and had a lot of political power, Jesus didn't have a lot kind of in common with them. You know, they didn't believe in the resurrection, for instance. They kind of put a different emphasis on which scriptures they emphasized. The Pharisees and Jesus were probably the closest of the groups. And so it's kind of striking that they're the group that he had the most kind
conflict
of
with.
Conflict with. Mm. Yeah, you'd figure, you know, and to some degree, I think that's kind of the way it is. The people who are closest to us are the ones that we kind of nitpick over. Mm. And I think that there's something about the Pharisees that I think speaks to us if we allow them to, right? Because the Pharisees, you know, they get a bit of a bad rap for having come up with all these rules. But the reality was that they were basically trying to apply scripture to people's lives, right? So the one that not that I'm super familiar with it, but you know, there were like, I think 30 or 32 prohibited activities on the Sabbath, right? And it wasn't as if the Pharisees had come up with all of them, but they developed this whole kind of system. And essentially it was to make sense of the commandment, don't work on the Sabbath, which sounds really easy. But, you know, for instance, how far can I walk before it's work? You know, and so they had what they called a Sabbath day's journey, right? Where you could walk a certain distance and anything kind of much more than that was, well, that's probably too much. You could walk to the synagogue, you could walk home, like those sorts of things. How many people could you cook for? Or could you cook for anybody? And some of the rules, you look at them now and they're a little bit pedantic, but they were all seeking to unpack. What does the Bible mean today? Mm. You know, fine, don't work. What does I mean? And so I think that there's lots that I think that secretly most Christians really liked the Pharisees if they understood them. Because like there's so much in scripture that's clear, but not like applied, right?
Yeah.
You know, I like, think about things like, you know, forgive one another. And inevitably that becomes a matter of, okay, yeah, but does forgiveness mean that I have to give them back trust? If I forgive them, do I have to remain in the relationship? What if the hurt has been, you know, like all those sorts of questions. Yeah. And you're like, exactly that. And the Pharisees would have just stepped right in and gone, here's the 17 things. You kind of go, oh, thank you. Right. Yeah. So I think there's a part of us, I think, that quite likes that sense of knowing.
That black and white.
Yeah. Just a little bit more clarity about what's going on. And so I think that when we seek to become really clear, which is valuable and helpful for us and for those that we might be following Jesus alongside of, what ends up happening, what happened for the Pharisees, is that those applications became codified as almost equal to the law itself.
Yeah.
Right? So Jesus shows up and his disciples are doing stuff that, as far as the Pharisees are concerned, constitutes work on the Sabbath. And Jesus is like, you kind of got this backwards.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know that Jesus disagreed with everything that they taught on the Sabbath, but his point was, you've kind of got this backwards. You've made the Sabbath about you, not about the other way around. God's given that to us. The Sabbath's for us, not the other way around. And so Jesus kind of rubs them the wrong way. And so I think that, you know, I'm kind of jumping ahead, but I think that as Christians, we can tend to become, as Belinda put it, we can become the law keepers, right? We become the law keepers. And again, like in the context of the Pharisees, that can sound like a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, slimy law keeper, you know,
and you're kind of like, Slytherin.
You're kind of like, no, keeping the law is actually kind of what it's all about.
Yeah.
You know, Jesus didn't say, law doesn't matter, just do what you like. Mm. No. He came to fulfill the law, to obey the law. He was the ultimate law keeper. And so we need to recognize that there's something really good in that. But what ends up happening is that we create a kind of a law alongside of what God is actually on about. Mm. And that our list then becomes the the paradigm through which we judge other people. Mm. And I think that's where it begins to impact the way other people encounter Jesus. Mm. Because, you know, in our context, you know, to Jess's point, we can't bring people to Jesus at the dinner party and say, "Hey, Jesus, do you have a minute to chat to my friend?"
Yeah, that would be fun.
You kind of like,
I'd go to that party.
Yeah, that's right. You know, where it's like, you guys hash it out. You know, you got questions? Well, here's Jesus. You ask him. And we can't do that. So people learn about Jesus from watching us.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah. And so if we are totally concerned about law keeping, rather than about the relationship that the law affords, that relationship with God, then what people are going to experience of Jesus is that he is just kind of Simon with the volume turned up.
Yeah.
That's how they're going to encounter him. Mm. They're going to think that Jesus is more about laws, and that shapes people's view of Jesus in fairly significant ways. I think that we can also then filter out some aspects of Jesus that are challenging to our law keeping. Mm. Things that Jesus did that were kind of like, yeah. But what he really meant was, right? You know, because we come like Simon in that moment in that story when Simon says to himself, essentially, as Belinda paraphrased it, "I knew it. I knew he couldn't be a prophet. Mm. If he really were a prophet, then he would have known X, Y, or Z. He would have known who this woman was and what had happened." And like, and I think we can sometimes kind of shape Jesus in our image.
Yeah.
So Jesus becomes, you know, a little bit like us, which means that then when people come to meet Jesus, they don't meet Jesus, they meet our caricature of Jesus. Mm. They don't meet the radical, amazing, awe-inspiring, honor-worthy person that Jesus was.
Yeah.
They meet some mitigated, you know, caricature, really, like a bit of a stereotype of who Jesus is. And I think that can be quite damaging for people's journey to Jesus as well. Mm. So I think those are, I think, two kind of dangers of that. And then I think, you know, I think the third way that we can kind of channel Simon is that we can end up making decisions about who should and shouldn't approach Jesus. Mm. You know, we can end up kind of saying, not that we would ever say this out loud because we know that theologically it's inappropriate, right? But this person should not be brought to Jesus. Like, we know theologically that everyone can come to Jesus. But our practice is often, if you act like that or behave like that or speak like that or think like that, you might be able to theoretically meet Jesus, but not here. Mm. Right. So I think that those are some of the dangers of it.
Mm. How would you suggest then? Because going back to the whole, like there's the law and then there's almost the laws behind the law, right? To help you. And that's what the Pharisees were kind of doing, but then kind of went too far down one end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of young Christians and Christians who are early in their journey who I think really crave that formula. Mm-hmm. You know, if A plus B equals C, then I know what's expected of me. And there's comfort in that. Yep. And I can totally appreciate that. And I search for it sometimes as well. So how do we exist in the tension of utilizing those things when they're available to us, because they are helpful, but not allowing them to become a law in and of themselves in our lives?
At the risk of overthinking it.
Isn't that what this podcast is all about?
Well, let's hope so.
It's three people overthinking things. Yeah?
Certainly not for me.
I think I may have mentioned this on the podcast before. One of the most influential books that I've read was a book called Christ and Culture by H. Richard Niebuhr. It was written, I believe, in 1949. And you might think, well, geez, that's a long time ago now. What possible value could it have? But the reality is that he talks about the ways in which Christians seek to follow Jesus in a pluralistic culture. So in that sense, it's like totally appropriate for now, because I think the world is more pluralistic now than when he was writing. And one of the challenges that he identifies for the church universal is that we take culturally bound applications, right? So if we take the Pharisees' application of what it means not to work on the Sabbath, and we call them applications, which are helpful, they're culturally constructed, they're time bound, they're useful. But he says what we tend to do with those is we end up kind of institutionalizing them. Mm. And we make them the law.
Yeah.
And then we carry them with us into a new time when all of a sudden those institutional answers just don't fit anymore.
Yeah. Mm.
And he brings it all back. And I hope this can answer the question. He brings it all back to the perennial problem that the church faces. And that is that essentially God is not static. He doesn't, is that right? God doesn't stay in one place, is what I'm trying to say. Like, God doesn't just remain kind of this monolithic, unchanging, right? Because, and while God's unchanging in his character, what he's doing in the world changes because the world changes.
Yeah.
And so we are always called to be watching what God is doing and responding according to what he's doing. And the lazy way, and not that Niebuhr puts it this way, but the lazy way is just to institutionalize the answer once we find it, right?
Yeah.
So we find a way to speak into a community or to a cultural situation, go, here's the answer. We institutionalize it, things change, and we go, no, the institution, that the answer, the law.
Yeah.
And we get caught with the Pharisees, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas in reality, we need to basically be able to say that answer worked then. It doesn't work now. Mm. And us changing doesn't mean that we're being inconsistent. It just means that we're trying to keep our eyes on what God's doing.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that that's a really helpful, I guess, a theological foundation for trying to avoid that, of just kind of going, you know, God's always at work, which means that we can't institutionalize our answers. We have to be asking the questions about, you know, what is God doing now? Where is he at work? And what does that mean for us? And continuing to ask that question and not kind of stopping and going, oh man, we figured God out. You know, that took a while, but man, you know, we got there in the
end.
Cracked
that nut.
Yeah. And now we've got this little box, and that's what ends up happening to churches again and again and again and again. Mm. We institutionalize. And I think that's ultimately the problem. So I think we need to be aware of the dynamic nature of God, right? Awesome. That God is always at work. And so we're always asked to do the hard work, right? And as Niebuhr put it, you know, he talks about the double movement of Jesus, right? That Jesus is forever calling us out of the world, right? Come out of her, my people. Don't be stained with the sins of the world. Don't be friends with the world. And at the same time, he is always sending us back to the world. Mm. Go make disciples, right? And so we've got this kind of, well, which is it, right? And sometimes, and this is the basis of his paradigms for how churches have tended to do this kind of thing, or how the people of God have tended to do this, where, you know, sometimes it's a runaway. That's our response. Sometimes it's to lean in and embrace and then kind of everything in between. So I think, you know, keeping in mind the dynamic nature of God, you know, like even in the story, you know, I mean, I suppose that if this woman had come to Jesus, and I think there's a little bit of ambiguity in terms of when she was forgiven, right? Mm. It seems like Jesus kind of forgives her on the spot, right? Rather than previously, but either way, like, let's just assume for the moment that she was not forgiven when she came into the room. There's an element there, of course, that you kind of go, okay, so what's going on here? Mm. Like, Jesus is interacting with someone who has had a sinful past that everyone's fully aware of, whatever that might be. How is he going to respond to her right here and now?
Yeah.
You know, and Jesus doesn't always respond in the same ways, right? Like, there's just this movement that takes place. And so I think there's a flexibility that we see in Jesus that we need to also embrace as best we can, and just kind of be like, watch Jesus and what's he doing, and how to do that, I think, is probably a fourth question, or possibly more, as the case might be.
Well, before we get on to a fourth question, let's move on to our second.
Question. So we've talked about this woman, and she's not given a name, but she's kind of labelled as sinful. And on a side note, I loved her comment of like, there's more ways for a woman to be sinful than just be a prostitute. Yeah, there are. I don't know why I thought that was cool. But
feminism.
Anyway, and so we see Jesus not shutting down this woman as Simon thought that he should be. How dare he let her touch him, all that kind of stuff. Jesus welcomes this woman who society and religion said was unworthy. And this is so vital for us as Christians. How do we go about welcoming those on the fringe or those people who we shouldn't necessarily be interacting with, people not of the world kind of vibe?
Yeah. I also really liked Belinda's comment about that. I was like, that's excellent. You know, and I think in the morning she actually put it a little bit slightly differently. She's like, you know, as if you were describing a sinful man, there'd be lots of ways to describe a sinful man, right? And she's like, and yet we tend to lack some imagination when it comes to the woman. I'm like, yeah, we do.
She could have been a major business tycoon selling drugs left, right, and center. Like, who knows?
Oh, no, she probably would have been a main character in this story.
Sorry, can we just...
No, we have to move on from that comment.
Oh, my gosh.
Also assuming that that's sinful, right? So, yeah, right. I reckon that the answer is actually really quite simple. At least, I think it's a simple answer. I don't know how to do it, right? But I think one of the profound pieces in the story that I think we need to recognize is that Jesus, because he is dishonored by Simon, is actually closer to the woman than he is to Simon. Like, he identifies with her as the one who is shamed, the one who is on the outer, the one who is disregarded, the one who is disrespected, the one who, yeah, listen, we know your reputation, but you're not nearly as good as your reputation. Like, so Jesus is marginalized in the story. And I think that for us, as people of God, if we're going to welcome people on the margins, we need to recognize that we too are marginalized and we need to be with them on the margins. Right? Because if we're not on the margins, it's really difficult to welcome people in, because then we're asking, it's like asking the woman, saying, come on, recline in the lounge, when she hasn't been officially invited, where the whole town knows that she hasn't been officially invited, where there's no real there's no kind of social conventions for her to kind of go, what do I do in that space? There's a likelihood that she had never been invited to that kind of an event before. She would have been completely out of her depth, because they're talking about spiritual things and biblical concepts, and so I think there's an element for us, we have to go to the margins. And Jesus identifies with her, right? He obviously doesn't identify with Simon, even though he's sitting at the table. And so I think that if we are to genuinely welcome people, we need to kind of go to them rather than just saying, you come to us, be like us. You can be like us. We'd love for you to be like us. That's not welcoming.
Yeah.
That's not welcoming.
And that's a risk, I suppose, of being so comfortable in your church and your community, is because we can get quite complacent with we fit in here, we belong here. And it's a kind of just a nuisance or to welcome people in from the fringes. Yeah. I don't know.
I think there are also, there's also the challenge, and I think I mentioned that Dan, one of our 6 p.m. crew, asked this question. So, being there with him as he kind of fleshed it out, because it kind of ties into question one, where there are times where many people in the church are sitting in Simon's seat and kind of have institutionalized, some applications of the law to the point where it is then exclusive to people. So how do we, as people seeking to include those on the fringe, also then manage people within our community who have institutionalized things that would exclude?
Yeah. I mean, some of this comes down to leadership. Some of it comes down to culture. And there's probably as many answers as there are congregations or circumstances or situations. Yeah. I think that we need to be reminded that the, you know, to some degree, the point of the messianic banquet, right?
Yeah.
Like Simon's banquet, the point was to kind of gather some important people and have a conversation. If you wanted to hang around the outsides and listen, that was fine. That was kind
of
the point.
Make a fool of Jesus.
Yeah, and that kind of made sense. And so everyone kind of knew the rules. Mm. But I think that there's value then in us kind of recognizing that, you know, there's an, if we're going to be inclusive, then we need to find ways to be inclusive, right? So if you think about the banquet scenario, we need to make sure there's enough lounges for everyone to recline,
yeah,
or we all stand, right? Like, ooh, do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's like, this is, we want this to be a level playing field in lots of ways. I've often noticed it when you know someone who is joining your, like, has kind of come to church, but you know that they don't have, say, a really strong church background, so that they're not really familiar with what's taking place, or even if they're just really new.
Yeah.
You just kind of watch what happens with a greater awareness. Mm. I'm just kind of going, oh, that's insider language. Oh, that's an inside joke.
Yep.
Oh, we just assume that they know who that is. Oh,
yeah.
You're just really aware. And some of that's natural. You know, I don't think you can explain everything every single time, because, you know, then the people, the majority of whom are there all the time, are like, we know this.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think we have to remember that not everything is clear for people. And that has to do with everything from how we announce things and how we, you know, signage in our buildings and like all those sorts of things, all the way through to our expectations around how people behave and those sorts of things, which is kind of part of the wider context of welcoming, the kind of the very physical relational welcoming piece. I think that's just hard work, because even then I want to put myself in the position of my friend Matt, who has not been to church in a long time. And when he did, he was in a Catholic church, and he's coming to a Baptist context decades later. I'm just really aware.
Yeah.
And what I'm doing in that space is I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, right? And that is the process of standing with those who are kind of on the outside and just thinking, how do I help you find your way? You know, if you've ever invited, if you've ever had a dinner party, and this is obviously not immediately, but you know, if you've ever had a dinner party,
I don't know, we've had a good week and a half.
That's right.
Freedom. I've had a few dinner parties, let me tell you.
But if you've had a dinner party where you've had lots of friends, say from one particular area of your life, and then say only one or two from another area of your life, you're, as a host, you're often really on the lookout for them. Introducing them around. Hey, Matt, just want to introduce you to Jess. I work with Jess, and so, you know, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of people I work with, Matt's a friend from high school. And we, you know, you just kind of do all this extra work to make sure, right? You're just making sure. And that's how you welcome people. And I think we know that. But it's as true of people who are marginalized.
Yeah.
I think what becomes difficult is when we, you know, to come back to the first question, we replace ourselves with Simon and we see someone and we say, you're on the outside. Or where we recognize that there is going to be a cultural or social or relational cost for me to welcome you, right? Where I'm going to have to associate with you in a way that some people may absolutely misunderstand.
Yeah.
Right? Where they're going to assume that my association with you is therefore an affirmation of your sinful life.
Yeah.
Right? That's when it gets more difficult. But it's still the same principle.
Yeah.
You're here.
Difficult in the sense of the heat you might cop. Not difficult to do. But yeah. And I think that's my question, is that sometimes there is that tension where people looking in can make their own assumptions about what that welcoming, or if or whether or not that welcoming should take place. But, you know, what we see here in this story is that that is absolutely what Jesus would have done. But sometimes we lose sight of that because of, you know, applications that we've institutionalized, as we've said,
to
make our faith feel a little bit more structured and clear cut, to the detriment of someone else being welcomed into.
Yeah.
And, you know, like we make assumptions about people, you know, know, like, and part of that's just natural.
Yeah.
It's kind of how we kind of, how we manage life. We kind of make some assumptions about certain things based on our experience. And sometimes we get those horribly wrong. And yeah, we're never going to be perfect in that space. But I reckon if we're going to welcome those who are on the outer, we have to recognize we need to move. We need to move rather than them.
Yeah.
Instead of saying them, yeah, come closer. It's like, no, no, no. Like, you need to... You know, it's like instead of asking them to join us at the table where they're just going to be super uncomfortable, we need to join them standing with the crowd around the table.
Yeah.
And for us to feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Kind of go, I'm used to kind of lying, reclining at the table. And here I am with a bunch of, you know.
Been standing for hours, my feet hurt.
Yeah. I'm standing around with you lot listening, you know, like, but that, you know, that's, I think... It seems to me that if we're going to be genuine in our welcome, we're going to have to be the ones to be uncomfortable in order to make others comfortable.
Yeah, great. That's awesome. Well, let's move on to question three. So, Mark, one of the big kind of tensions in this story is how Simon is kind of... has set Jesus up to experience some pretty extreme dishonor. Mm-hmm. I mean, we wouldn't call it dishonor, but contextually it was. And then for the woman to kind of come in and try and replace that honor on him. And I guess it sparks for us this question of how do we honor Jesus when we live in a society that so regularly shames him?
Yeah, and for those of you who haven't listened to the sermon or are kind of wondering what in the world are you talking about, this is the story in Luke chapter 7. And the research that Belinda pulled from was done by Kenneth Bailey, who's a scholar who relies on Middle Eastern culture today, particularly rural cultures, and says essentially that he argues that the culture hasn't changed a lot. So you can actually learn a bit about what was going on biblically by reflecting on what's happening even today. Long story. At any rate, so what he draws out in his reading of Luke chapter 7 is that Simon does not welcome Jesus as he should have been, right? So there's two parts to it. The banquet, as we've implied, you'd have the kind of the reclining guests, the official guests, and they're the ones who would be engaged in the conversation. But these sorts of parties were open to kind of anyone to show up. They didn't get to recline at the table, but they could hang around the outside and they could listen. You know, so if there were a great rabbi in town, like a Jesus, and Simon had him over for his house, you could actually show up and kind of listen in on the conversation. That was kind of part and parcel of it. So this woman is in kind of on that outer edge, listening in. But as Jesus draws attention to at the end, Simon didn't wash his feet, didn't give him a kiss when he entered, and didn't anoint him with oil. Kind of three components of your standard welcome, particularly someone who's honored. So in essence, Jesus ends up being dishonored by Simon. And the point then that Bailey makes, that Belinda kind of pushed on, excuse me, is that this woman does what Simon did not. Right? So she kisses him, she washes his feet, and anoints him.
Robitussin.
That's right. So that's the welcoming piece. And so she seeks to honor Jesus where, wow.
Would you like
some? Yeah, do you need some water? Yeah.
No, I think that one did it. We'll find out though. Forget the roof. It's the coffee that's the problem. So that's kind of the context, in which case her tears are not tears just of gratitude for being forgiven or tears of sorrow at her sinfulness. They're actually tears that are sort of angry at how Jesus has been dishonored and that what she is seeking to do is to honor Jesus as best she can. Now, I think intriguingly, she ends up doing it in a way that probably would have brought a little bit of shame on her.
Yeah.
Right? She's a sinful woman, whatever that means. But like she's, you know, washing his feet with her tears. Like normally it was water that was used. Normally a woman And Belinda didn't draw this out, and for the nature, just from the context of time, but normally a woman would not let her hair down in public, and yet she does to wipe his feet dry, kisses his feet. You know, as Kat pointed out, who was service leading with me in the morning, she's like, I've always felt that the whole kissing the feet thing was just really weird. and to some degree, it is, right? But the reality was, as Belinda pointed out, she couldn't kiss him on the cheek as someone might have greeted him, because he was reclining with his feet out. Like, it was the only part of Jesus that she could kiss.
Yeah.
And so she does. And then she anoints him with the perfume that she has brought, seemingly as a gift for him in some way, shape, or form. So I think that I'm not sure that would have relieved the tension, right? I'm not sure that the group of people would have gone, oh, wow, Simon really kind of botched the welcome, and then watched the women kind of go, yeah, she did it perfectly. I think they would have been going, oh, this is just as weird as Simon not welcoming Jesus. So anyway, that's kind of the piece. And so I think the question then, that whole idea of, so in a culture where Jesus is regularly dishonored, or at least where he is not treated with the honor that we would feel that he is due, how do we go about honoring him? Right? That's just the question. And Belinda made, I think, a really helpful point, a couple of them in this relationship. I think one is that the woman used what was in her hands. Right? Like you drew attention to it as well.
She's resourceful.
Resourceful. Woman. You know, like she's weeping and she kind of, you know, I think Belinda put it this way in the evening. She's like, and she kind of goes, oh yeah, I can use that. You know?
Although that's got to be a lot of tears to clean his feet sufficiently to then kiss them.
Well, I dare say
like she's really going hard. That's an ugly cry for sure. That's not just a silent tear.
Yeah.
Like listening.
Yeah. And even that, when you think about it, like, that increases the awkward.
Yeah, that's a scene. That's a proper scene.
It's not just that woman is here.
Yeah.
It's that
she's ugly crying in the corner.
Well, and not even in the corner.
Yeah.
She's in the middle of the room. Right at
so I think there's something in that. Hey, right. But, you know, that whole idea, she's resourceful. She uses what's kind of at her disposal. But also, and I think this was really helpful, she doesn't confront Simon. She doesn't kind of, you know, drag him off his lounge and say, you jerk, I can't believe you had dishonored Jesus this way. She doesn't confront him that way. Now, there were probably lots of social reasons why that was not an option for her. But she doesn't yell. She makes a bit of a scene, but it's not, you know, she doesn't fight anybody. It's just she does what she can. And in doing so, draws attention to herself in a way that probably would have been unwelcome. Until Jesus kind of goes, do you see this woman?
Yeah.
She knows what's going on. So I think when we consider a culture that routinely disrespects Jesus, right? I think that there's a couple of things that we can take away from the woman's behavior. I think one of them is that we're called to, as Jesus himself did, not to break a bruised reed or extinguish a smoldering wick, right? Like, we're not the ones to kind of bang on about it and force people to respect Jesus. And no, I don't think we're called to kind of necessarily call people to that in their words so much. But in our actions, I think our actions ought to demonstrate and almost beg the question from people, like, why do you act like that? Right? Because to some degree, that's the question that people would have asked her. Like, you just made a bit of a spectacle of yourself there, love.
Why are you embarrassing yourself so
much?
Yeah,
like, what? Yeah, what in the world? And for her, like, you know, we don't know for sure, but I think her answer would have been, you don't know him like I know him.
Yeah.
Like, he has forgiven me. He has given me peace. He has welcomed me back into community and into relationship with God. Like, you don't know him the way I do. Like, that story he told was mine. I owed 500 denarii. Like, it was 500 days wages, 2 years days, like that. You know, it's kind of the general sense of a denarii. Like, I was the great debtor and I've been forgiven. You don't know him the way I do. He is like, if I have to make a fool of myself, you know, as Paul says in some of his letters, if I have to make a fool of myself, I'll do it. I'll go even further. Right? I'd like, you don't know him the way I know him. And that's the sort of behavior that's going to beg the question of who is Jesus again?
Yeah.
Like, I thought he was just some sort of caricature. I thought he was just some guy, some teacher who wandered around, said a bunch of stuff, and now the church has ruined it all. Right? Like,
heavy.
Yeah. Yeah. How's that for a summary?
That escalated quickly.
A summary of Christendom.
Not wrong.
You know, but it's going to force people to kind of go back to Jesus and kind of go, okay, well, if you're going to behave that way, I mean, people will either write you off and kind of go, you're an idiot. Or they're going to be asking, maybe I need to re-examine who Jesus is, because I didn't think he was worth that kind of an outpouring. I didn't think he was worth that kind of behavior, but you're saying that he is. Let me reinvestigate. And I think that's probably, without being specific at all, I think that's what we're called to be doing. We need to be saying, okay, so if I'm going to honor Jesus with my life, then how do I do that? What does it look like to honor someone with my life? To honor his teaching, to honor his ways, to respect his name, to be respectful, to honor him. I think, and even if that means that we have to do things that appear a little bit shameful in our culture, I think that's what we have to cop, right? That's that whole, we want to bear shame for his name, right? Not because we're sadists and we want to suffer, but just that whole sense of it's so worth honoring Jesus.
Yeah.
And so I think, it probably begins as well with us really getting a good handle on who Jesus is and recognizing that, Jesus is really worth honoring. And when we find that, then I think we'll be in a better position to honor him in our actions.
Yeah, great stuff.
Love that.
Love it. Well, what a great way to kind of wrap up our discussion today. Thanks so much, Raider, for joining us for another week of the Big Three.
Pleasure.
So, Jessica Baker.
Matthew Willis.
They were three big questions.
They were,
What kind of stood out for you in all that?
I love the discussion around question one of how we do most of the time resonate with Simon a little bit too much. I think in my own experience, that kind of craving for the black and white, it does send you down a path where you've kind of missed the point. And I've had plenty of conversations with people who don't know Jesus if that's what they get caught up on. Oh, well, I don't want to be a Christian because, I want to live my life. And so if you're going too far down the wrong way, for you, you're fixating too much on it and you miss the point of Jesus. But for them, it can be really damaging and they don't see Jesus. All they see is the rules that you're kind of forcing, forced yourself to live by. But in the same way, we do need, following the law is really important.
You can't just throw it out.
Yeah. But I think it's really important to show kind of other aspects of Jesus rather than just you've got to be sexually pure and you can't get drunk and blah, 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 which, we'll have to do. But
but it's walking that tightrope, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I guess that then flows into the second question where allowing those to then exclude people from meeting Jesus is not the example that we see in Jesus.
Yeah.
And so if anything, Jesus had more problem with the people who were keeping those kinds of rules than he did with those who weren't.
Mm-hmm.
I dig that. Mm-hmm. I also find that honoring piece. I think that is something that we don't talk about.
Yeah.
Much that, we talk around it. We talk about the life that we are called to live and what it means to follow Jesus. But I don't think we actually talk about it in terms of that our behavior is an outpouring of honor to Jesus. Mm. And that it's not just how we kind of behave or talk about who Jesus is. It's just also the way that when we kind of take on his name as a follower of Jesus, it's then how we live our life. And again, not to just follow rules, but to how we reflect who Jesus is a reflection of our honor of him. And I think it's important that we understand that sometimes will result in us being making a scene in the middle of the room, pouring our tears on someone's feet and wiping our hair across it.
Yeah, I think that's why I love this, the way we told this story so much. So I resonate with that woman. Like,
what, having a seat?
Just having a seat. Having good an cry. Ugly cry. Everyone going like, okay.
I love a good cry. I love a good cry.
But if I could do that for Jesus and not just because something else has happened, like.
Not while watching a good Huggies ad. It's just beautiful. Well, thank you, my friend, for another episode of The Big Three, and I'll see you Sunday night.
Yes, in the flesh.
In the flesh, if you register. No. Well, if you want to be a part of the conversation, make sure that you're there at one of our services this Sunday, and then you snap the Slido QR code before the sermon to get involved. A reminder that GBC has opened our on-site services on Friday morning at 10 a.m. and Sunday night at 6 p.m. Just head to guymebaptist.org.au to register, and we'd love to see you there. If you've enjoyed the Big Three podcast today, take the time to give a star rating and be sure to subscribe to stay up to date with all future episodes. Thanks for joining us for another week of the Big Three and our deep dive into God's invitation for us all. Remember that there's no thought too small, no question too big.